This episode of the Deck Tees Podcast is brought to you by Gathering Magic and CoolStuffInc.com. Become a part of their customer rewards program when you make any purchase and receive discounts on all future orders. That is CoolStuffInc.com. Welcome to episode 105 of the Deck Tees Podcast. I am your host, Erin Campbell. My guest today is a popular deck builder who is a fixture of the Star City Games Open Series circuit. He's also a new dad and a big old math geek. He is Jeff Hoogland. Hello.
Howdy, howdy.
How's it going?
Things are going pretty well.
Good, good. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
I'm excited that my power's still on to be on the show. We had a big storm just blow through here.
I read about that. I think I was reading something on Gawker, and they had the weather map, and it was kind of like this ring, and the ring had different circles to it, almost like a bullseye. And like if you were in the outer ring, you had like a 2% chance, and then the closer the ring got to the circle, to the middle, you had a higher chance of the storm hitting you. And I was like in the 2% ring, so it hasn't quite hit me yet.
Rained cats and dogs here not long ago.
Oh, well, I'm glad you could make it. I've wanted you on the show for a while because I love what you do, and I've run into you at several events, and I think you're really great, and I just needed a really good time to have you on. And I feel like, you know, we're going through a new standard. I figure we both have a lot of opinions on this, and we could sort of hash those out, and then I could also get to know you at the same time. So hopefully that sounds okay with you.
Yeah, definitely. I always say, you know, post-rotation is Christmas, and now Christmas is going to be coming twice a year before long here.
Are you excited about that? Like, are you okay with the changes?
I think that's fantastic. Those changes are awesome for someone like me that wants to do different things all the time, and they only really negatively impact the people that want to sit there on the best deck of the format and just grind it constantly.
Right. Now, that's something I always find really interesting about deck builders and like yourself, and something I'm always really curious about. What is it about you that makes you gravitate towards your own brews as opposed to the popular decks? Because I don't think I ever saw you, you know, pick up something like a mono black or a mono blue devotion. You were playing Bug and you were playing Junk and you were playing Jund. Like, what is it about that that attracts you to that?
I think the closest thing I've ever played to a stock tier one deck in the last 3 years, just so that I've been playing competitive Magic, I played Brave Naya for a few months towards the end of the last standard season, but I was still playing Fabled Heroes inside of that shell, so it was explosive and interesting, I thought at least. Magic is a game that's built variants by design, which is both one of the best things and the worst things about the game. So I'm always of the opinion that if you're going to have to run a little bit hot to be successful into a top eight, you might as well do it while playing something at least a little bit interesting.
So is it just that you don't enjoy the popular decks, or is it something a little more?
A lot of the times the things that are popular are, you know, they're streamlined to the point that I find the decision trees dry. Mm-hmm. And, being a math geek, as you said, I love problem solving, and basically I approach every game of Magic as a problem to solve, so the more decisions I get to make in solving that problem, the more interesting it is for me.
Mm-hmm. Now, I noticed that you kept going through this past standard that we had, because I stopped. I mean, like, once I saw kind of how things were going, I quit standard, like, in January of last year. Like, I just wasn't having it, and I moved on to Modern. But I was still seeing you, you know, go to the events and try your hardest. Was that hard for you to do, like, just seeing the environment and how stale it was?
It can be tough at times. The big thing that you have to get used to if you want to be someone that tries to work outside the box in Magic is that you're going to fail a lot. Mm-hmm. Like, for every one successful idea you have, you're probably going to have a dozen or more decks that are just absolutely crap. And there's just not enough time in the day to test all of your ideas at length. So you're going to show up to events sometimes with a pile of cardboard that's definitely not optimal.
Mm-hmm. And how do you deal with the criticism? Because I feel like we have a lot of people in the community who, you know, when you post a list on Twitter, or, you know, you in general, not you personally, Jeff, but, you know, if you try to say on Twitter, hey, I've got this really great idea, I feel like people's default response is to immediately tell you why it can't work or why it won't work. And I know that gets me down a lot, to the point where I don't even want to share my ideas. Like, how do you overcome that?
Just like with everything in the world, especially on the internet, anyone with an anonymous nickname has an opinion, and they generally disagree with you. You basically just got to learn how to cancel out that signal to noise ratio, and you learn which people to ignore right off the bat, basically, and which ones are generally more open to bouncing ideas off of. Personally, I try not to shut down a particular idea, like, is this card constructed playable or not, until we actually, you know, get a real chance to give it a go.
I'm also guilty of falling into that trap of there being too much information out there, where I will see a deck that I enjoy or a deck that I might want to play, and then I start reading all these articles, and there's so many, and then this person is saying, play this card, and that person's saying, don't play this card, and then someone played the deck, but they didn't have any of those cards, and then I almost don't know what to do, and I just don't know how to tune out that white noise. That's a big obstacle for me.
Honestly, if you want to be able to work outside the box, you got to learn to trust your gut with things. I do, and I know, and a lot of people disagree with this, is like, especially when a new format comes out, I do a lot of testing against myself. I look at the ideas that other people are putting out there, and I, you know, play both decks myself. And if I can beat their deck with what I'm doing, then maybe my deck's genuinely good versus, you know, in 30 or 40 games, which one comes out of head.
Now, do you have a team that you test with, or do you do this all by yourself?
I don't have a specific team. There's a number of other grinders that I bounce ideas off with, you know, on the social media. I'm very active on Twitter and Facebook and even Reddit. So lots of ideas bouncing around on there all times. Cockatrice is actually, I think, a fantastic tool for testing with people that you know.
I've also seen you plugging a thing called X-Mage.
Yeah, so X-Mage is basically a open source Magic the Gathering online clone for playing Magic functionally, which is awesome for playing with people you don't know, because then you don't have to bicker about rules interactions with them.
Or with Cockatrice, I know a lot of times you have to do all of the motions yourself. Or like if you have a card that gives you a +1/+1 counter, you have to put it on yourself. And if you're playing against somebody who may not know how to do that, that can be a little frustrating too.
Yeah, so honestly, I think the best way to use Cockatrice is, I even use Cockatrice when I have people physically come over to my house, because then we don't have to break out Sharpies and bulk cards, and we don't have to shuffle decks ourselves. We just, you know, sit along the couch on the laptops and load it up, and it goes really fast compared to actually paper testing.
Right. Yeah, I think that's my main problem, is I feel like I don't have anyone to test with, and I feel like there's only so much I can do by myself, and my local scene isn't the healthiest, so we don't have a lot of opportunities to play, and I really do feel like if I was playing more, maybe I would lose better, maybe I would brew better, maybe I would understand certain lines of play better, and I feel like it all comes back to experience and how I just need more of it. So.
Yep, and honestly, I feel like everyone thinks that they don't get enough practice and they don't have, you know, enough experience with their particular deck or their particular brew that they're working on, and it's really hard to get very happy with a very specific 75.
So let's talk about the current format. So we are in post-rotation standard. We are going on 2 weeks of this.
All Heil Courser of Prudence.
Oh, my goodness. So we've had two opens that have taken place so far. One was in Indianapolis and one was in Jersey, I believe.
Yes, yeah, and okay. I was present in Indianapolis, and just looking at the top decks between the two, I'd be curious to know from someone that was in New Jersey, what did the field look like? Because I know in Indianapolis, there were just green devotion decks and green midrange decks just everywhere. And there was not the normal aggressive presence that you normally expect week one.
Right. From looking at the two lists, it seems like one of them had a lot of monsters lists. Like, it feels like Jersey, if I'm looking at this, from what I can see, it looks like Jersey was more devotion, at least in terms of the top decks, and Indy was more monsters. That's the way it looks
to
me.
Yeah, that's probably fair. And then Jersey also had the two breakout Jeskai Tempo decks.
Okay, now what do you think about Jeskai Tempo? Because there's a lot of fuss about whether or not it's really Tempo.
I think the people that are splitting hairs about what exactly you're calling the deck are probably not spending enough time actually playing it to figure out if it's good or not. I think you do classify that as a tempo deck. I've been playing, Modern's a great example. I've been playing a burn-based Delver deck in Modern, and there's only four counter spells in the main deck, which are Remand, and I consider that a tempo deck for sure.
Now, did you have any predictions going into this? Like, what did you expect to happen, or what were you thinking was going to happen?
I think assuming that Courser of Krufix decks were going to be powerful choices was definitely where most people were at heading into the format. I actually wasn't expecting the Green Devotion strategies to port so well. Kent Ketter's a fantastic example. He top 32'd in Indianapolis, and the only cards from cons he was playing in his Green Devotion shell were fetch lands.
Now, see, I wasn't surprised about Mono Green at all. I was surprised by Jeskai because it looks so simple. Like, a lot of people were chalking its success up to Mantis Rider, and maybe it's just the black mage in me, but I was like, okay, it's a 3/3 flying haste vigilance for what looks harmless enough. Like, I had no idea that that card alone would make Jeskai a thing.
Now, I could be get blasted on this and be completely wrong, but I think long term moving into the format that deck was so successful because people weren't ready for it. A lot of people were of the opinion that burn decks weren't going to be good and weren't going to be valid, so it wasn't on anyone's radar. But definitely I've ground a number of games with that deck and similar decks past that, and the Siege Rhino deck seemed like really hard matchups for that deck.
Yeah, I was very happy to see Siege Rhino do well. I had a feeling it was going to do well. I was also not surprised by all the Goblin Rabble Master I saw. And I know that you were using it in a Jund deck towards the end of rotation, weren't you?
Yeah, definitely. Okay. I think that card is very, very at home in a mid-range shell.
I have to say I was a little sad to see people doing what I told them not to, the Butcher of the Horde and Goblin Rabble Master, Jeffrey. I did not want to see that.
They're so very, very good. So in Indianapolis, two people in my car played a bug control deck, and okay. I was one of the two people that played that, and we were not so successful. But two other people in the car played a black, white, red mid-range deck that was featuring Breemaw's Rabble Master and Butcher of the Horde, and they both top 64 to the event with 7-3 or better records.
And you made them walk home, right? Because that's, no. I mean, that's what I would have done, but that's just me.
Well, Thoughtseize into Packrat was the play last season. Thoughtseize into the Goblin Rebel Master is almost better, in all honesty.
Man, I can't believe that we're here. Speaking of bug, what did you think of the Sultai Delve list that Todd Anderson and Brad Nelson played?
I think that's probably one of the more powerful takes on bug in the format. Mm-hmm. I think everyone that's playing the bug-colored shells right now, them included, is not playing nearly enough dig through time.
Yes.
That card is stupid powerful. Whenever you get into a long game, every turn you're just like, you know what I want to draw this turn? I like to draw dig through time. So why are you only playing two of them if that's the card you really want to draw?
Didn't you say in your article this week that you put out on the Midori that you thought it was better than Treasure Cruise?
I think in every shell that doesn't care about having to pay an additional colored mana, that dig through time is going to be more powerful than Treasure Cruise, for sure.
And why is that?
On average, regardless of what your deck is, the best two out of your top seven are going to have more impact on the game than three randoms off the top.
I think you also said that one of the commentators had made a comment that people were dying with a handful of cards. Was that your article?
Yes.
Or someone else's? Okay.
They all blur after a while, but that's definitely true. So, like, having the specific answers is better than just having this grip full of... I think it's definitely true that, like, this current standard format is pushing more towards card selection versus raw card advantage being what you're going for.
Mm-hmm. I was happy to see the Sultai list, because I'm a Sultai fan myself, and obviously a black mage, but I felt like they didn't go all in on the delve. Like, I feel like if that's going to be your plan, you need to go all in on that. And I just felt like they were trying to play almost too fair, where, like, you know, they really should have been doing some unfair things. Would you agree with that?
They were definitely more split, and I think that was just more so because they didn't want to necessarily get blown out by any of the graveyard interaction that still exists in the format. Mm-hmm. It's sparse, but if someone came to beat them and they were all in on that plan, they were going to lose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was really happy to see that. I love Sidisi. I think Sidisi is definitely capable of some crazy things. And I know Brad wrote a post today saying how he admitted that it was basically a pile and he doesn't know. He's like, yeah, I just came to an event with a bad deck and somehow made, you know, top 32.
So I really like Sidisi, but I feel like she imposes a lot of deck building constraints, not only on your mana, but also on the stipulation that if you're playing this card, you need a bunch of creatures in your deck to make it reasonable. Mm-hmm.
It also seems like they keep trying to make her work with the dread strategy, where it's like people want to go Sidisi into Night Howler and all of that. And I don't know. I think that might be doing too much. Like, You know, I
Yeah,
can.
it might be very well possible that you just want some kind of bug mid-range shell that's just playing a bunch of creatures and like it's not really interacting with its graveyard other than like murderous cuts and dig through times.
Another deck that made some headlines this past weekend was this Ascendancy combo. What
Oh,
is
jeez.
that?
The Ascendancy combo deck in Indy, Andrew Bestrom, he actually lost playing for top eight in round 10. He was 8-1 after 9 rounds and couldn't draw in.
What? So I'm looking at this deck. Okay, so if I understand this correctly, it's so you get your Jeskai Ascendancy down and you play some mana dorks. Like there's really no like real creatures in here. And you just whack off behind that until your mana dorks are really big and then swing. Like, is that it?
That's the game plan. So you play a bunch of really, really cheap spells. So basically, if you have multiple mana dorks, when they untap from your trigger, you net mana with every spell you cast, and eventually you pick up your entire deck and then have a giant creature. And some of them, the ones in Indy, were actually both using Retraction Helix to be able to bounce blockers.
Jesus. And is this a thing? Like, do you see this becoming a real threat in standard?
So the problem with a deck like this is it's only as good as people want to let it be. People that want to beat this out of their sideboard or even possibly in their main deck are always going to be able to beat this.
I just want to Thoughtseize them. Like, that's my first thought looking at this, because from what I understand, they have to mulligan a lot. Like, it's you know, you have to have the right cards, and I just want to turn one Thoughtseize and be like, well, thanks for coming.
Well, I don't know that it's necessarily true that they have to mulligan a lot. While they do need specific cards, all of the cards that they need to play are found via Commune with the Gods, and they were also playing Dig Through Time in their deck to fuel what they want to do.
Right. Now, two kinds of decks that were noticeably absent were aggro and control. Where were they? Why weren't they here?
So the aggro decks ran into a bunch of decks playing four Nylea's Disciples and were appropriately crushed under heal.
Where'd all the
And
control
then
decks go?
the control decks, people are afraid to show up with control decks week one. It's a really tough thing to do. And actually, now that we have this data, it's probably very possible that we see some kind of deck utilizing End Hostilities that goes real deep into the Pro Tour here in 2 weeks.
I was also expecting, a lot of people predicted that Ashiok would be good because Ashiok is very good against mid-range strategies, and we had so many of them. And again, I was really surprised that, you know, between End Hostilities, Thoughtseize, you know, Downfalls, Banishing Lades, that there wasn't something there, and it just wasn't. And I was really surprised by that.
So the big thing, so all those then those colors you just named are Esper colors. So now you have your deck that wants to play Thoughtseize, and we're playing Esper, so our fixing demands that we probably play 6 to 8 fetches. There's no good life gain in those colors anymore. We don't have Sphinx's Revelation off of the top to prevent us from dying once we've stabilized, to a Stormbreath Dragon off the top or something along that nature. So control gets much harder to build.
I also heard people blaming the lack of control on the mana cost of End Hostilities. Does that one extra mana make that much of a difference?
So it definitely does make a difference, but what those people are overlooking, I think, is that End Hostilities is fantastic against all of these mid-range decks. And actually, in my article this week, I ran some stats on all of the decks we had from week one, and something like 75% of the decks that did well on week one were mid-range decks. So End Hostilities is very reasonable against decks like that. And you don't have just this top-end sweeper. If you're playing Mardu control, you have Anger of the Gods at 3, and if you're playing Esper, you have Drown in Sorrow at 3. So you don't have to play just one sweeper.
Yeah, I think I want to get on the Constellation horse because I love Constellation, and I'm actually going to SCG Minneapolis at the end of this month, and I feel like there's a nice little window that I could maybe crawl through and get a little, you know, get a little action in with Constellation. I know Ross Merriam had brushed on the Constellation theme. Like he had some Doomwakes and he had some Eidolons and he had Faerika in his deck and he really liked that. And I'd like to kind of go a little deeper on that and see if I can maybe, you know, I always set the bar kind of low. I'd be happy with like a 6 and 4 or, you know, something like that. And maybe I could hit that, you know?
Well, I will also be in Minneapolis later this month. That
Can
one's fairly close to me, so
I
that'll
have to
be.
say, if I play Constellation, I do want to try, and I'm a baddie, I'm warning you right now, but I totally want to play Extinguish All Hope.
That card costs 6, right?
Yeah, but it kills all their stuff except enchantments, and I will
No,
have
yeah,
a board.
I think that's probably fine. Like you're playing a Corsair Caryatid deck, you're living to 6 mana.
Yeah, and then everything
So.
I have is enchantments like Doomwakes and Eidolons and whatever, so.
In all honesty, I think the Constellation Shell is in a similar boat to the Jeskai Ascendancy combo, and that it's going to be a fantastic choice so long as you can accept that you're not going to be able to beat the people that they really, really want to beat you. Mm-hmm. Like, the guy that decides, I'm going to play four Back to Nature this weekend, like, he's going to beat you, and that's fine. Like, not everyone is going to be doing that. In fact, most people won't be doing that.
So what are your predictions going forward? Like, where do you see the standard going?
I definitely think once we find the right End Hostilities deck, people are going to learn just how good Dig Through Time really is.
Yeah.
I think that's going to be the real winner, is finding the right shell that's going to be sweeping up everything that these mid-range decks are trying to put on the table.
Do you think Rug and Bug are going to make a splash?
Rug is actually a really interesting concept because I really enjoy playing tempo style decks, and that's what I play in Modern for the most part. And a big thing, the fact that the sweeper that exists in the format can now be countered, mm-hmm. I think that's more relevant than the fact that it costs 5 mana.
Yeah.
So it allows something like a tempo strategy to actually evolve, probably out of the Rug colors with the Tamir Charm and the, what's the bad spell Pierce with Ferocity? I'm blanking on its name.
I'm not sure.
Disdainful Strike.
There we go.
That's the one. I think it is. That card is also very reasonable, I think.
Absolutely. So enough about Standard. I want to talk about you, Jeff Hoogland. So I did a little bit of research on you, like I do for all of my guests. And I understand that you grew up in Alsip, Illinois. Is that correct?
Yep. It's okay. A small suburb on the south side of Chicago.
Okay. And what was your childhood like? Like, what were you like as a kid?
I was fairly obnoxious. You'd probably, if you asked me, you asked my parents. Yeah. So one thing that a lot of people don't know about me is that I was homeschooled for most of my grade school and high school career.
Really?
Yep. So my mother homeschooled myself and both of my brothers.
Any particular reason? Like, was it for religious reasons or?
My mother just had some issues with the local public school system, so she pulled us out during grade school, and then once we got to high school age, we always had the option if we wanted to go to school, we could. But I mean, you tell a 14-year-old kid, you can sleep till 11 o'clock every day and then wake up and do your work, or you could wake up at 7 a.m. and go to school. Like, that, the option there is real easy.
Do you feel like you missed out on anything, like any social interactions by being homeschooled?
No, I don't think so. And the thing I always told people for a long time is, like, if you're only getting your social interaction from your schooling, they're the one with the problem, not me. Mm-hmm. So there was plenty of things to do. I mentioned before we started that I did a lot of theater stuff growing up and through college, and I also was a fairly active member of the BSA for a long time. My father was an Eagle Scout, and he was big on their program.
Oh, so you were a Boy Scout too?
Yep.
Okay, how far did you get?
So I got through Star in those ranks, and then I did Boy Scouts also has a program called Venturing, okay. Which is co-ed, and that's actually how I met my wife.
Seriously, you met your wife in Boy Scouts?
Yep.
I need to hear about this.
So Venturing is just a co-ed branch of the Boy Scouts for people ages 14 to 21. And she was a member of the crew that we were in. And then so we met when I was 16 or 17. And then a couple of years later, we started dating. And then the rest is history, as they say.
Wow, so you guys were high school sweethearts.
Kind of. She's a couple of years older than me, so...
Oh my goodness, you were dating an older girl?
And now I'm married to one.
My goodness, this just keeps getting better and better. And you were together continuously, like through high school and college? You didn't like take any breaks or anything?
We didn't start dating until after high school. We just did the Boy Scouts together while I was in high school.
Okay, well, that's a really awesome story. I didn't know that. Yep. So did any of your current interests or hobbies take root at an early age? Like, you know, I know that you're into math and you're into computers. Like, was it true back then as well?
So I started playing Magic just after Apocalypse released. So that was 2000, 2001. So that means I was 10. So I've been playing Magic for a very long time.
Wow. And you're how old now?
23.
Okay. God, it's crazy when you actually say it, like when the words come out of your mouth and you're like, I've been playing Magic for like 10 years or 15 years. You're like, Jesus.
Yep. And... It's really, if you would have told 10-year-old me that, you know, a decade and a half from now, you're going to be, you know, making a reasonable amount of your living playing this card game, I'd have been like, what? No way.
So how did you discover Magic? Did some friends introduce it to you, or did some family members get it for you?
One of my cousins had a giant stack of prophecy cards gifted to him from a neighbor,
Okay.
and we had a seventh edition rule book, and we taught ourselves how to play Magic from that rule book, which, if you've ever seen a pair of 10 and 11 year olds try to teach themselves how to play a game, we played very, very incorrectly to start.
Were you a gamer in other areas, or did you just play Magic?
I played a lot of Dungeons and Dragons through high school and college. In fact, the house I lived in during college, at one point we had games of D&D going there, I think 6 nights a week.
Wow. That's pretty hardcore.
Yeah, I only played 4 nights a week, so I wasn't all in.
I love that you're trying to like distance yourself. You're like, I only play 4 weeks or 4 days a week. It's not like I don't respect myself at all. Like, just distance, distance. And then what led you to start getting into competitive magic?
So, I moved down to where I live now in central Illinois in Bloomington to start my master's program. And it was towards my last semester of that that I was decided to show up at the local card shop for F&M and met some people. And then a couple months later, like, hey, there's this big Magic tournament, an hour and a half away from here in Collinsville. It's run by Star City. Let's go. So, we all showed up there Saturday morning and got thoroughly crushed. I think my first standard open, I went 1-3-1, unintentionally drawing in the first round.
And yet you kept coming back. You still had the fire.
Oh, I am a glutton for punishment. So that was during, for the timelines for people that are familiar with Magic's for the last 4 or 5 years, that was during Scar's Innistrad standard, was when I
Remember
really started playing competitively.
that.
And
Okay.
I, actually, my first open top eight was with a Bug Glissa the Traitor control deck.
Oh, Jesus. Was that like Ratchet Bomb and all that stuff?
Oh, yeah, it was main deck Ratchet Bombs, main deck Nihil Spell Bombs. I think I hold the title of being the only one to ever put a Grim Backwoods into a constructed top eight.
That is spicy, Jeff.
It was something. In fact, it featured not one, not two, not three, but four Evolving Wilds in the mana base.
Oh, Jesus. And you had your degree in math, is that right?
Yep, both my undergraduate and my master's degree are in mathematics.
Now, why mathematics? Like, do you like doing math?
I love problem solving, and while I was going to school, I was already getting paid to both fix computers and write freelance code here and there. So I really didn't want to pay a university to teach me things I was already doing. So I was like, math is kind of neat, and it's hard to learn that on your own. Okay, you can teach me math. I'll give you money to do that.
I like to say that I work for a bank, so I'm no good at math because I'm not.
It's funny, when people find out I have a math degree, they often give me a what they think is a really complex arithmetic problem, and I'm like, I'm not a calculator. Degrees in math means I can read a math book.
I guess that's true with any profession. Like, if you were to tell somebody you're a stand-up comedian, the first thing they say is, "Make me laugh," or "Tell me a joke," and you're like, "I'm on the spot. Like, I don't know what to do." And you teach math now.
Yep, I teach part-time at a college down in Springfield, Illinois.
Okay. Do you enjoy it?
I really, really like teaching, so hopefully I can do that more full-time someday. It's really hard to get started as a full-time teacher because they want lots of years of experience to get going.
Now, when I was researching you, Jeff, I admit that I'm not tech girl. Like, I'm not very tech savvy. And something kept coming up the more I kept reading about you, and you even have it in your email. What is Linux? What is that?
So, Linux is an operating system kind of like OS X or Windows is,
Okay.
and it is generally speaking, it is free and open source, meaning it's not only free of charge, but everyone can view the source code that runs the operating system itself.
Okay, now you've really got to break it down for me. What does that mean? So like for Windows, does that mean I can't see the source code?
Correct. So
Okay.
no one other than Microsoft has any idea how Windows works. And that's why, like when all that Snowden stuff happened earlier this year or last year, people were like, well, the NSA has backdoors where they've paid who to put what in our code.
Okay.
So, because only Microsoft really knows what's going on.
Okay, so it's a good thing that Linux is so transparent.
Correct.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure because it kept coming up, and like I said, I am so bad at this stuff. And I was like, well, it sounds good, but what does it mean?
To
So.
To connect with real people, Linux powers probably upwards of 80% of the servers that host different websites. Android smartphones are Linux-based. Your TiVo runs on Linux.
Wow.
Things
So
like that.
So it's all around me, and I didn't even know that.
Yep, basically. Jeez. All got the little penguin inside of it.
And you have the little penguin as your Skype icon, I see.
I do.
Okay, I didn't even realize that. So
that's Tux. He's the Linux icon.
His name is Tux?
Yep,
T-U-X. That's adorable. So in addition to your math and your teaching and your playing magic, you also write about magic. And you've written for a number of websites, and I've followed you to all of them. But you seem to have really found your niche with the metery. How did that partnership get started?
So I'd like to start by saying the guy that started the metery, Ian Anderson, he's both a fantastic individual and a really good businessman, I think.
Did he pay you to say that?
And he did not pay me to say it, but I might try and hit him up for something now that I've said it. So I'd been writing about magic off and on, and actually before I even starting for specific websites, I wrote a lot of just self posts on Reddit, which is what actually got me picked up by the first site I wrote for, which was wrote for a site called Deck Factory for a couple of months. Mm-hmm. And then I really liked what the Ian was doing with the metery, this concept of trying to build not only a website that hosts articles, but also has like this basically this Twitter focused on magic aspect behind it. That's what the metery actually is. It's kind of a social network with a magic focus.
Mm-hmm. And what is it like to write?
And I really like that the couple of sites I've written for before, and even the couple, I actually have a couple articles published on Star City as well. They the guys behind the metery, they're understand the technology, which I can appreciate. So I had a lot less issues with the couple of articles that I posted there, you know, like cards not being tagged, or if there was an issue, it got fixed really quickly, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. And do you have the freedom to write about what you want to? Do you have any hard deadlines or anything like that?
He is so super flexible. It is fantastic. Like this week, for instance, Khan's cards still aren't on Magic Online for whatever reason, but that's another discussion. So I was like, hey, instead of streaming this week, I'm going to go ahead and write two articles because I want to talk about Standard, but I also really want to talk about this Modern deck that I've been working on for a while. So those need to be separate pieces. He's like, yeah, sure, whatever. Go ahead and just do what you want, basically. And that's been fantastic to have basically the creative freedom to write on anything Magic related.
Yeah. I am so in awe of the metery because there's really no other store like it out there. Like, I remember when I went to GP Minneapolis and you knew you were in metery town. Like, I mean, there were t-shirts everywhere and sleeves and playmats. And I've been to quite a few GPs and quite a few opens, and I've never been to an event like that and seen a store represented so well. And it really is just crazy.
If you get a chance to actually go to the brick and mortar store when you go to Minneapolis, it's called Mead Hall Games. It's actually not that far from the convention center. It's themed like a Mead Hall.
Really?
There are long wooden tables in it and benches and chandelier-ish things hanging from the ceilings. It's got a great theme going on.
Yeah, I would like to check it out. I'm just so amazed by it. So we've never really seen a store, you know, do what they're doing right now in terms of branding and like you said, making their own social network, and it's definitely one of a kind right there. So.
Yep, definitely. And actually, as someone that's played sponsored for a couple of different teams now, the Metery custom sleeves are fantastic compared to all of the other ones I've had to use.
Nice.
In fact, part of the reasons I stopped playing for one of the teams was their sleeves were just so miserable to play with. That
I simply cannot work under these conditions.
No, it was bad. I was like, I'll wear the shirts, but do I have to use the sleeves? And they're like, yeah, we need. I was like, oh, well, I think this is going to be the last one then, guys.
Nice. One of the things I've noticed about you in terms of your grind is that you seem to prefer the Star City circuit. Like, I very rarely see you going to a PTQ or going to a GP. Like, you seem to enjoy the opens and the invitationals. Would you say that's pretty accurate?
Yeah, definitely. So, I'd like to prefix the statement with saying that my wife is one of the most supportive people in the world, and she is awesome and encourages me to play a bunch of Magic. But that being said, she loves me playing Magic a lot more when it doesn't cost us money, mm-hmm. or likes it even better when it makes us money, mm-hmm. and that's myself included. So I think just from the, you know, basic math that I've done, that it's it's much easier to break even or even turn a profit grinding the Star City Circuit versus PTQs and Grand Prix.
And why is that?
Basically, so, you know, because I mentioned earlier, you know, Magic is a variance by design game, which is fantastic. But even comparing it to, say, a Grand Prix, there's one big tournament on that weekend. So you're making this commitment and you're driving, you know, 5, maybe even 10 hours if you're really dedicated to get to this tournament. And if you have a bad run, that's it. You're done. Try again next time. The Star City events, there's two major events every weekend. So if you have a crappy standard day, you get a second shot on Sunday. Mm-hmm.
Now, do you think, now, what about somebody like me who doesn't play Legacy, but they play Modern? Like, is that still a possibility for me? Like, does that still make the Opens better than the GPs?
I think so. Last, in Indianapolis was the first time I've played a Legacy Open in the last, I want to say, 3.5, maybe 4 months. The last three Opens I went to before that, I played the Modern 5K on Sunday just because I really enjoy playing that format.
Mm-hmm. Do you think they're onto something with the Moderns? Like, is it going to stay just an IQ, or do you think they could maybe do something more with it?
I have no connection with Star City and don't have any real grounds other than my gut for what I'm about to say, but I think the introducing of Modern 5Ks is a great transition plan long term. Mm-hmm. Like, I could see it very easily, you know, moving to Modern Open Legacy 5K as, you know, we get further into the years and Legacy staples become harder and harder to acquire and more costly to do so.
Mm-hmm. Now, you brought up your wife, and you two recently celebrated the birth of your first child, who was adorable, by the way.
Thank you.
Looks very much like you.
Yep.
If you don't mind me
saying
that.
And soon he will have more hair than me, I'm sure.
And you said that your wife was very supportive of you playing Magic.
Yes, she's fantastic. I know a lot of people, like, when we go to events, they're like, oh, my wife let me come out and play this week. And I was like, my wife packed my bag and said, you know, I'll see you when you get back. She's like, you know, she knows that this is what I want to do. And this is basically, you know, kind of like work for me. So she encourages me to head on as many of these trips as I can get to.
Mm-hmm. Now, were there any difficulties when you had the baby? Like, did that put a crimp in anything, or did you have to sort of renegotiate your time? Like, how did you manage to get back into the grind so soon?
So, it was funny. There was actually an open 6.5 hours for me, which is in my normal drive range, the weekend my son was born. And that was 2 weeks before his due date. And there was just something where, like, we should skip this one. Like, it's close and it's close to the date, but we're going to wait. And then he ended up coming that weekend. So it's just like something was there. We're like, okay. And then everything lined up.
Mm-hmm. And how do you juggle it all? The teaching, the grinding, fatherhood, how do you do it?
It's, you know, time management's really important. So I am lucky enough that the teaching that I do is in the evening. So I am actually basically a stay-at-home dad during the day. I do grading and obviously writing Magic stuff, but I am at home taking care of Jacob, our son, during the day for the most part.
Mm-hmm. Is fatherhood what you thought it would be? Do you enjoy it?
It's so much more. It's amazing. That's just having this little tiny person that it's weird, but it's becoming the norm. Mm-hmm.
Do you see yourself having any more little Hooglins?
Possibly. It's something that we're talking about.
Okay. You have to grind even more events just to feed them all.
Right?
Baby needs a new pair of shoes and a bonnet and a crib, and come on.
Come on.
Now, I've noticed very recently, Jeff, that you've been criticized a little on social media for being outspoken about certain things. I know that you were, for a while there, you weren't a big fan of Legacy, or you had made comments about Brainstorm being very, very prevalent. And just recently, there have been some comments about your criticism of Magic Online. Do you really dislike these things as much as you come off? Like, do you really not like Legacy? Do you really think Magic Online is this shit show? You know, what's going on there?
So I'll take these in pieces. The first one is Legacy, because I think that one's actually easier to tackle than Magic Online. basically, you know, I wrote about, and a lot of people felt like when I wrote about Legacy that I was attacking this format that they loved. And really, I was just trying to explain why I don't feel like it's the right format for the type of Magic I like to play, for me to be playing.
Okay.
And the reason is, we talked about how I like to try and work outside the box. And it's really hard to work outside the box in a format like Legacy. There's so many inherently powerful cards that are just so much better than all of the other cards in the format, that when you're not playing those cards or a particular combination of them, you're really doing yourself a huge disservice, much more so than you would be in a format like Modern or Standard where things are less defined.
Okay. And is that something you think that anybody can fix?
I definitely think if Wizards took a more hands-on approach with Legacy, they could sculpt the format in a similar way that they've sculpted Modern via bans and unbans, that they could change the power level of things and make, you know, new cards more interesting more often.
What would you like to see banned in Legacy?
Oh, geez. I think the best way to shake up Legacy in its current format is I would ban Delver and Show and Tell.
Really?
I do think that while Brainstorm is powerful, that's a card I've been a huge critic of. The biggest problem with Brainstorm is the fact that for fair decks, Blue's gotten these just really powerful tempo creatures in the form of Delver and True Name Nemesis lately that really push that card over the top. But at the same time, I think with the addition of Grizzlebrand and Emrakul to the game, I don't think you can ban Delver without simultaneously taking out Show and Tell, because that deck will one rampant if there's not a strong tempo deck keeping it down.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have yet to get into Legacy, but I have to say I've been very pleased with the fact that Dredge has been popping up lately. How did this happen?
It was in Columbus earlier this year. I was like 5-1 or 6-1 in the open, and I lost the die roll, and my opponent goes, "I will draw." And I was like, oh boy, if there is anything playing Legacy on Magic Online has taught me, it's how to play against the $67 Manalish Dredge deck.
I love
it. And in all honesty, I think that is the reason why Dredge has been so popular. Like, even in paper, Manalish Dredge, I believe, still comes at under $200, which is very, very cheap for a Legacy deck that's even mildly competitive.
But, you know, and I was researching Dredge because I was thinking of picking it up myself. And I mean, there is hate out there. Like, I mean, Deathrite is a thing, and Leyline of the Void is a thing, and Relic is a thing. Like, how is it? Are people just sleeping on the hate? Like, they're not thinking it's a threat, and that's why it's getting through?
You seem to love these decks, and it's going to be very similar to, you know, Living End in Modern, which I know you love, mm-hmm. and the Constellation deck and the Jeskai Ascendancy combo deck in Standard, and in that if someone shows up and they go, you know what I'm not going to do today? I'm not going to lose to fucking Dredge. They're not going to lose to Dredge. They're gonna have 12 cards to board in, and they're all going to nuke the graveyard or mess with things you want to do, and you're just not going to have a good time. But most people aren't doing that, and Legacy is, there's so many different angles that people are coming at you from in the format that you can't devote 12 cards to Dredge without hurting other matchups.
And Dredge really requires that many answers to deal with?
In all honesty, I think if you want to have, unless you're playing a specific type of deck, I think like the blue tempo decks, like the Delver decks, they probably need 5 cards at least to beat Dredge fairly consistently.
Wow. And I wouldn't think that. Like, I mean, especially maybe I'm just underestimating it, or maybe I'm just naive, but
and obviously when I say a statement like that, I'm talking about, let's say we have, you know, LSV or John Finkel playing both sides of the match, like perfect play on both sides. Mm-hmm. You're going to need probably that many sideboard cards to win consistently. But that being said, you know, perfect play is something that never happens in Magic, and even great play is rare. So people's opinions of those particular matchups are definitely very skewed by both, you know, their opponent playing poorly or them playing exceptionally better than them.
I was also surprised to hear from my friends that Jund is not so great in Legacy because it doesn't do well against the combo decks. Is that true?
Yeah, that's correct. So because we have this really broken card called Brainstorm, if you strip all of the relevant cards out of their hand, they untap, draw one card, brainstorm into 3 more, and then kill you.
Okay. Yeah.
This is one of my favorite stories. So I am very known for playing Life from the Loam, Chalice of the Void decks in Legacy.
Chalice of the Void. That is like garlic to a vampire. I play Living End. You can't dangle that card in front of me, Jeff.
In Legacy, we put it on 1.
Really?
We put it on 1 a whole bunch because, you know, probably upwards of 50% of the spells most people play in Legacy cost 1 mana.
Okay, so that's Delver, Brainstorm, Deathrite, Lightning Bolt.
Lightning Bolt, Inquisition, Thoughtseize, Swords to Plowshares, Ponder, Preordain.
Jesus.
Every card in the elf deck that you care about for the most part.
Wow, that's a pretty... I had no idea. I'm so used to it just being Chalice for zero, and I'm like, shit.
Yep, so Chalice on one's the big strong play that I like to do. But anywho, so I'm playing against the straw that broke my legacy back for a long time that made me put the format aside and go, I just need a break. I had a Storm player dead on board, and I had a Phyrexian Revoker on LED and a Chalice on one and a Chalice on zero, and my Storm opponent untapped and killed me.
Oh, that's not good.
Like, I mean, the deck's really powerful. Mm-hmm. I was like, nope, just need to take a break.
So I want to talk about your relationship with Magic Online. Like I said, you know, you've been very vocal about it. I recall you mentioning something on Twitter that you don't think it's that bad. So what's going on there?
So Magic Online is one of those things where everyone that's complaining about it being terrible, for the most part, is doing so because they just want it to be better.
Okay.
Playing Magic on demand is something basically every Magic player wants to be good, and they want to be able to do it when they want to do it, and they don't want to have to deal with all of the issues that the current client has.
Okay. Now, what is it that people like me are not seeing? Because I'm not saying that you're wrong necessarily, Jeff, but, you know, when I was at the Community Cup, I played it for a good 4 days, and I pop in every once in a while, and I don't necessarily see where the outrage is. Like, what am I missing?
So, for starters, actually, I watched some of the Cup coverage, and you were great. but, so, for starters, the systems that they had at the Community Cup, they were running gaming laptops for the purpose of playing this digital card game. Mm-hmm. A kind of application that shouldn't just run need a gaming laptop to run. It should run on tablets and phones, and heck, it should probably even just work in my web browser in 2014.
Okay. So you're saying like something like we were using, like our laptops, that's something that's meant for like a more powerful game, like maybe a StarCraft or a WoW?
And even those are low on games, you know, think like people that are gamers, you know, the latest version of Crysis with the Crytek engine and things that are like pristine, beautiful graphics.
Okay, so you're saying that we shouldn't have needed that nice of laptops just to get a good experience from Modo.
Correct.
Okay.
And I think one of the biggest issues with Magic Online is their communication with the community is very, very poor at mm-hmm. best. The Spire Spine bug recently is a fantastic example of things that are wrong with Modo in the process that they handle things. The Magic the Gathering Online team thought an acceptable solution to this card that is bugged and losing people games is the people that lose the Spire Spine bug, they can file for reimbursement until we get this patch 2 weeks later at our normal weekly downtime.
That doesn't sound very good.
That doesn't sound very good. In fact, you know, and this isn't the first time that something like that's happened. A great example is the last time the Mox was actually working, there were a bunch of people in the top eight playing zombie decks because Pillar of Flame wasn't exiling zombies.
I remember that.
Yep. That's and at a certain point, like the Spire Spine bug especially, why don't you just emergency ban this card that doesn't belong in any constructed decks in the first place from being able to be played? So instead of ruining a bunch of people's experience that are trying to use your product, you just, you know, you've ruined the experience for the trolls that are trying to abuse the bug.
I have to say that was something I was a little confused by, because when we were at the Community Cup and there was, so we were able to play cons a week before everybody else. So the last day we turned against each other and we played a cons pre-release, if you will. And we were actually given a list of cards, and it was almost like a bug report. Like there were five or six cards that were bugged, and there was one card, which I don't know if I can name, so I'm just not going to because I don't want to get sued. And there was one card that had a massive bug where it had the potential to, like, you know, completely ruin the game, completely ruin all of our games if we played the card. And I have to admit, there was a little part of me that was like, really? Like, why are they here then? Or why are we able to not only open them, but use them? Like, especially for the Community Cup, like, I just thought it was a little strange. Like, I just assumed that for our experience, that might have been taken care of, and then that wasn't the case.
And the thing that amazes me about that is the teams working on developing Magic Online, they can work with Magic R&D and know what these cards are in advance. They have a long lead time to test bugs and get these cards working correctly. Mm-hmm. By comparison, the X-Mage client that you mentioned earlier today, within a week of the full spoiler being released, they had programmed every card in the set.
Wow.
in a week. And I'm not saying every one of those cards was bug-free. They have a public bug tracker where you can see the issues that people are having with things. But the people working on the game interact with the people on the bug tracker, and they say, hey, okay, this is fixed. The next build is tomorrow. You'll get it then. Not, you know, next Wednesday for 7 hours of downtime. It might be working after that.
Mm-hmm. Now, I do want to play devil's advocate for a minute, because I tend to be of the mindset where if you feel that strongly about the product, and not you personally, but you in general, like if you feel that strongly about it, why do you keep playing it? And I do see that you still play Modo. So why do you keep doing it then?
So I've actually made efforts to stream using X-Mage the last few weeks.
And okay.
For the last month or so, I've actually only used Modo during my weekly stream for the metery.
Okay.
Another part of it, though, when I was really playing a lot of Magic Online, is if you're really good, if you're reasonable at Magic, you can make money playing Magic Online. I posted a number of tweets. When I first started playing the Blue-White-Red Delver deck, I made, I want to say, $300 in just over 2 weeks cashing out tickets from playing that deck in daily events and 8-mans.
Really? How do you do that? Like, I don't understand.
So you just, you know, you play daily events, you win booster packs, you sell booster packs for tickets, and there's plenty of online services or even other people that will PayPal you money for tickets.
That they can just buy in the store?
Yeah, so you sell tickets for less than the store sells them for. So in the store, a ticket costs $1.08. So tickets over PayPal or person to person usually go for 95 or 96 cents a piece.
Interesting.
So, you know, someone buying 200 or 300 tickets saves, you know, 10%.
Wow. I had no idea. And I'm sorry.
While we're on the topic of Magic Online, I think one of the biggest things that I think needs to change with Magic Online to make it better is they really treat it like a secondhand product compared to the paper releases. Mm-hmm. There's the only reason they delay these Magic Online releases reasonably is, like you said, you played with most of the con cards at the Community Cup. That was, what, almost 2 weeks ago now?
Yeah.
So they have the cards ready. They're simply waiting so it doesn't overshadow the paper product. And they shouldn't do that. If your paper product is that reasonable, people are going to come out and play the games. People want to play Magic with paper cards. Don't make your premier online product suffer. Treat it like a premier online product and give it, you know, similar release dates, and only actually hold things up when you have to.
Mm-hmm. What is your response when you hear things from Wizards like, you know, well, we have all of these jobs available and we need you to help us fix it and come work for us and come be part of the solution? Like, what do you think when you hear that?
I think that if you want to pay me somewhere in the mid 60s to be a programmer in Seattle, you can get bent. Like, I would expect to make, you know, low 60s working as a development programmer like that, living in the middle of Illinois, surrounded by cornfields. Like, that is not a reasonable starting salary. So when you pay crap, you get crap. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you've ever looked at, like, the Glassdoor website where employees rate their employers.
Yeah.
Everything that's not R&D related in Wizards has very poor ratings. It's not inspiring in the least.
Yeah, I had read that, and it's not that I didn't believe it necessarily, but I just felt like I kind of took everything with a grain of salt, where I was like, well.
No, yeah, definitely. Like, these are people that are pissed off. But I mean, like, right. Even if you have everything they're saying or take 25%, it's still pretty unreasonable.
Sure. So I mean, like you said, though, you do want it to succeed, though. Like, you're not cheering that it's failing.
No, yeah. I mean, if we give them, like, Magic Online is not an appropriate quality level for a product that requires you to spend hundreds and even sometimes thousands of dollars on.
I remember that when the news came out that Blizzard was canceling Titan, I know people were looking at Wizards and going, they're canceling a product rather than release something that's, you know, not good enough, not finished to the public. And what's your excuse?
Yep.
I thought that was...
I think it's often shocking that someone that has a R&D department for their paper card game that's as amazing as Wizards can find it acceptable to put out a digital product that's so poor.
Yeah. So what are your competitive goals, Jeff? Like, what are you looking to accomplish? Where do you see yourself in the next couple of years?
In general, I just like to play a bunch of Magic. Like I said, I like to play a bunch of Magic, and I like to, be as financially sane while doing it as possible. So last year I had an amazing year. I had, an Invitational top eight and over a half a dozen Open top eights. This year I've just had a bunch of top 32s, and I had one top eight earlier in May. But even with those finishes, I'm still breaking even on the year after a couple plane tickets on, tournament winnings.
And you're okay with that? Like you're not chasing the pro tour, you're not looking to win an invitational or anything like that?
I mean, I like to play in the invitationals because I think the dual format that's both constructed is very interesting. So I think it would be fantastic to do that. I am hoping that I still have an outside shot at possibly making the SCG Players Championship for this year. The amount of points needed to make that event are definitely higher than I first expected them to be at the beginning of the year.
I'm still trying to figure out what it is.
Well, so the format for the Players Championship itself is very confusing, and I'm just going to worry about figuring it out if I actually make it.
It's easier for me to break things down into tier systems. So I'm looking at it going, okay, so you do your opens, you go to your SCG opens, and you earn your open points. And then you get your open points, and then that gets you to the invitational, right? And then you do well at the invitational, and then you get to the championship? No?
So if you win an invitational, so think of an invitational as a giant qualifying tournament for the Players Championship.
Okay. And
Whoever
that's.
gets first at the invitational, they get a seat at the championship at the end of the year.
Okay, and how else can you get a seat at the championship? Just from points?
Yeah, so they're 16 slots, and the four of these other slots, so there's the four invitational winners, and then each of the quarters for the open points, they give the highest point earner from that quarter an invite as well.
Okay, so that's what that leaderboard on the main page is about.
Correct. And
Okay.
then so the slots that I am vying for come the end of the year here is that essentially the top eight players that aren't already qualified on that leaderboard get invites as well, based on at-large points.
Okay, so as of right now, you are listed as number 14 on that board. What does that mean?
That is correct. So it gets a little bit more complicated because I said you have to be top eight on there that isn't already qualified. And the key to see there is I think there's three or maybe even four people above me on that leaderboard that are already qualified. So for instance, Chris Van Meter's qualified, and
Tom Ross.
Brian Bronduin's qualified, and Tom Ross is qualified. So basically, if the season were to end today, everyone through 12th place would be and up would be qualified for the event.
Okay, but you're 14 though.
I am 14. I have some work to do.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure I understood because I didn't want to be like, congratulations, and you're like, I'm not going.
Correct. So we still have a little bit of the season to go here. It's through the Invitational in Seattle, like the second weekend in December. So I still have some catch up that's possible for me to do to make it in there.
All right. Well, I will certainly be rooting for you. Like I said, I love what you do. You've always been super friendly to me when I've run into you at events. You've been super patient with me on Twitter, despite my stupidity sometimes. And I really do wish you well. And I would love to see you crush these events. So good luck.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you.
And if anybody has enjoyed listening to you on the show, Jeff, how can they get a hold of you? Where can they find you?
Like I mentioned earlier, I'm super active on both Twitter and Facebook. You can find me just at Jeff Hoagland on Twitter, and same name on Facebook. Feel free to just give me an ad. I love chatting about Magic. I won't always get back to you right away because I get a lot of messages, but I do try to talk to everyone that shoots me something about this deck list or that idea or not.
Okay, and it's Hoagland, not Hoogland?
It is Hoagland.
Hoagland. Okay, because I've been calling you like Hoognasty and Hoogastank, and it's Ho.
We say Hoogle, my friends and I, but the name is actually pronounced Hoagland. Yep.
Okay, so now when I call your baby the Hoagling, that it makes sense now. Hoagle. Okay, got it. So,
That's one of those Ellis Isle mess ups where when the Hoaglands immigrated here however many years ago, and an OA got smudged into an OO.
I tend to hear that a lot with my name. Like, I mean, my last name is Campbell, so I just say Campbell like the soup. And it's amazing how many ways that gets mispronounced or even misspelled. Like, they're like, can you spell it? And I'm like, it like the soup, like you don't, and they don't know. Like I when I say soup, I assume that that's going to be an easy answer for them. Like, oh, I love Campbell's soup. And then they'll write down my name. And I can't tell you how many times I've been like, Campbell, like the soup. And they're like, that's nice. Could you spell it? Like, I don't understand. I'm like, what's going on? So it's been a pleasure having you on, and I look forward to seeing you again sometime soon.
Excellent. Thanks for having me. Man, I will see you at the open in Minneapolis at the end of the month.
Yes, I can't wait. And if anybody's enjoyed what they've heard here on the Deck Tees, you can always find the show first and foremost on GatheringMagic.com. The show is on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Please subscribe and leave me a review and some stars. You can keep up with the show on Twitter at the Deck Tees. You can keep up with me at Original Estrus, and you can also email me personally at estrus@elitistjerks.com. Thank you guys so much for listening, and please take care of yourselves, okay? Bye.